Could we maybe start? Thanks to everyone again for coming. Very nice to see you all. I've got a few sort of administrative announcements, though, for a change. The first is, got lots of extra copies of the book list here. But rather than giving them out, I'll simply leave them on the floor here for anyone who cares to pick one up. We didn't get one before, so just dump them down here somewhere. Secondly, I checked, the book list, in fact, hasn't been put on the website. Several people asked me this, but I am getting it put on the website today, I believe, so it should be available on there if you don't want it in paper form. Second, very relevant to what I'm going to talk about today, since today I'm going to talk about the collapse of communism and its implications, I was asked to announce by Stuart Locke that there will be a meeting called The Revolutionary Ideas of Karl Marx. The Revolutionary Ideas of Karl Marx. The speaker is Alex Kalinikos, who is a very good speaker. And the meeting is going to be in room S50 at 4 o'clock Thursday the 27th, i.e. tomorrow. Room S50 at 4 o'clock Thursday the 27th. The Revolutionary Ideas of Karl Marx. I'll be talking just a bit about those today, but more about where they've all got to and why, to me, they no longer seem as revolutionary as once they did. Next point, an audio tape. Several people asked me for whether or not these lectures are recorded on audio tape. Well, they are, not apparently on video anymore, but on audio tape. And an audio tape is going to be put in the library every week after these lectures, if anyone does want to listen to it. I mean, sorry, it sounds egoistic, but someone did ask me about it, so I thought I'd announce it. Next, I was also asked about the school's attitude towards learning disabilities, and I'd just like to mention a few things about that. First thing is, the school does, of course, take the issue of learning disabilities seriously. Don't know whoever asked me about it is here, but it was about a couple of lectures ago. We offer some special library services, free photocopying, book collection service if you find it take long time to get the book by yourself. Also offer extra time for exams, and in special cases, use of a PC. The school also can fund testing for dyslexia. There are apparently some funds available for student support, and local authorities also allocate larger sums, at least for UK students, I think. I was also asked to say the Students' Union is also closely involved in providing support for dyslexic students. Fifthly, it's something about the level of these lectures. I mean, I was just talking to a few people, and I did originally, and I still think of these lectures as being relatively elementary. In other words, is designed primarily for first-year students in undergraduate or, to some extent, graduate, at least, MSc courses. I mean, I'm happy with a complete diversity, of course, in the audience to come, but I thought I'd just mention this because I got an email from someone saying, why don't you make lectures a bit more demanding? And last time I tried to make it slightly more demanding, I got another email from someone else saying, couldn't understand what you were saying, can you make it a bit more elementary? So trying to steer a line, but basically they were supposed to be fairly introductory lectures to give some sense of where I think the big issues in the social sciences are at the moment. And I do apologize about not being able to talk to every level of person in the audience, and I'm sure some people will want to know a lot more about some things that I have to gloss over fairly quickly. Finally, something very important. There is a mechanism for offering suggestions in the LSE. I don't know how many people know about this recently set up. Can I just mention, for email suggestions, I better put it on here. It's the email of the person who's sort of taking the suggestions that people make. These are supposed to be serious suggestions, by the way. It's Nan Caro P. Dot. N-A-N-C-A-R-R-O-W, capital P. Dot. It's Paul Nan Caro. There are also going to be suggestion boxes in the main entrance as you come in the old building and in St. Clement's building for people who don't like using email. But I would like to have your suggestions if anyone's got any to offer, especially about, I mean, they can be about any aspects of the school, really, that you find irritating or that you think we should try and improve insofar as we can do. But for the moment, I'd also like to ask if anyone here has any academic suggestions. What I mean by that is, are there any cutting-edge things academically in the school which we're not doing but we should think of doing? If anyone has any positive ideas about areas of intellectual life that we don't cover but we should cover, I'd really like to hear from you via the email or one of the other suggestion boxes. Briefly put, you know, my take on the LSE is that the great period of the LSE was really, I think, in the post-war time after the Second World War, when it was the place where the welfare state and sort of wider set of social policies were pioneered. What I'm trying to say in these lectures is that we now live in a very, very different environment from this, in terms of business, in terms of markets, in terms of government, in terms of personal life, as I'll be trying to show. I think the LSE should be the place that responds to these changes, and it should be the place where an orientation is worked out towards them. I don't mean by this anything politically partisan. I mean, this is still the biggest and most intense group of social scientists working together in the world. I would like it to be the place where these cutting-edge issues are made sense of and also communicated to the wider world. I think it's very important for the LSE, as it were, to reinvent the role of public intellectual, to make sure that universities aren't too closed off from the wider world. I'd like the LSE again, I mean, as it has been for a long time, but to push this further, to be the leader in the intellectual debates, but also to make a contribution to public debate too. So if anyone does have any suggestions from, for example, any course you might have followed anywhere else that you found particularly interesting that the LSE does not do, anything you can think of that you think is really at the outer edge of academic advance or intellectual advance, I'd be very grateful for anything anyone will care to send in. You know, not the kind of sod-off things, but things that are sort of positive suggestions, if possible. But this would apply also to any aspect of school life. Getting on quickly with the agenda of the lecture, then. I'm sorry that this took so long. If I can remind where I got to last time. Last time I suggested there were four main overall dimensions of globalization. The debate about globalization, I tried to propose to you, is the debate of the moment in the social sciences. There are big divisions of opinion about what globalization is, what it's leading to, what are its dynamic forces. There are big divisions of opinion about this. Nevertheless, that debate is the core debate in the social sciences at the moment because it spills over into all areas of social life. My view on it, that I tried to emphasize last time, is that although globalizing influences are driven primarily by economic forces, not by, as it were, the power of the collective will by government, they are creating something of a global society, a new form of society with new institutions which are not those with which we've grown up, not those with which we're familiar. The task of the social sciences is to chart out the contours of this society and see what we can make of it in terms of our own interventions in it. The four dimensions that I mentioned last time are all risk scenarios on the one hand. They all create enormous risks for humanity at the end of the 20th century. They also all create energizing possibilities. They all provide a morality for our endeavors, I think. In terms of risk, some of the big risks are, we've seen them this week, possible collapse of global financial markets. connected to economic globalization, the development of a global market society. Second, ecological risk, risks associated with human intervention in nature. Third, political risks, problems, strains of democracy, possible rise again of authoritarian forms of government. And fourthly, risk to do with the means of violence, proliferation of nuclear weaponry, and other forms of military power in the world. That's the negative scenario. That is the sort of, these are parameters we have to face up to. They're all real risks. On the other hand, each of these four gives us the ideals to which I would hold we should strive, which we should strive after. First of all, on the level of economic organization of the global society, containment and hopefully elimination of poverty as a major endeavor of the next few decades. A realistic endeavor, I think, in terms of absolute poverty. Second, a society which lives in harmony with nature rather than one which despoils it. Third, a world driven by democratization, recognition of the authenticity of human rights, a genuinely cosmopolitan society where different cultures can coexist. And fourthly, a peaceful world free from the threat of violence. These, I think, are the energizing ideals of our age. I must say, personally, I'm very hostile to postmodernist interpretations of modernity that suggest there is nothing left to strive for, that there is only cynicism, there is only fragmentation. This is not true. We live in a world where there are major possibilities of improving the lot of humanity, and we must push for these possibilities, and in these lectures I'm trying to indicate how we might do so. Now, for most of the 20th century, there's been one major political vehicle which has pushed for such possibilities, or at least has ideologically sought after them. This vehicle, this set of social movements, is that link to the name of Karl Marx. As was mentioned earlier, truly a revolutionary thinker. Marx and Marxism, until no more than 10 years ago, made more impact on 20th century history than any other competing idea system. Even if you looked at the major world religions, I think you would have to say that Marx and Marxism have been more important than they have been in the 20th century. In producing social change, of course, in causing social conflict too, but in transforming the world. In these lectures, I'm not going to discuss Marx's ideas in detail, but what Marx sought was a humane society which would replace what he saw as an irrational system, precisely the system we live under, the system of global capitalism. For Marx, capitalism was not an effective way of organizing the fruits of industrial production. For Marx, capitalism produced major social divisions. Capitalism is a cyclical society. It's not a society which is responsive to human will. It is a society energized by markets rather than by human wants and needs. It is a society based on the commodity, the buying and selling of things, which Marx thought could often be dehumanizing. Capitalism is a poor way of organizing an industrial system, so Marx thought. And this idea was the dominant idea of socialism through the 20th century. Putting things very crudely, you can say there have been two sets of socialist movements in the 20th century. I mean, it's very crude because there have been many more. There are many subdivisions. First, you have revolutionary socialism, which has invoked many people who regarded themselves and been regarded as communists. And second, reformist socialism, which has been the preeminent form of socialism in Western countries. Revolutionary socialism looks for the radical transformation of capitalism, the emergence of a society based upon collective ownership of the means of production, a classless society which will be dominated by a single class, the working class, who Marx thought would be the inheritors of history. Revolutionary socialism is the driving ideology of Soviet communism, of Chinese communism, and the other forms of expressly communist society that have existed in the 20th century. Now, when you think the term communism, be very careful, because it's become such a scare term, at least for many people in the West and indeed in the East in the 20th century. Remember what communism originally meant. Communism originally meant recognizing the communal or social or interdependent nature of human experience. Communism was an attempt to stress our interdependence. That's the basic idea of the commune or the community. Tony Blair could quite well be called a communist because his emphasis on community exactly recaptures some of the emphases of the early communist movement in the first part of the 19th century in Europe. Communism only became, as it were, a scare thing when it became Soviet-style or Chinese-style communism as a particular form of state in the 20th century. And this is what I'm going to talk about in this lecture. Reformist socialism is the socialism of the British Labour Party, of most Western European Labour parties. Most Labour parties have believed that capitalism shares many of the characteristics which Marx attributed to it, but that one has to live along with it and produce a mixed economy, an economy where the state plays a role, where some industries are nationalized, for example, but where other areas are left open to the market. Reformist socialism is a more modest, progressive, non-revolutionary form of socialism, and many, many reformist socialist governments have been in power in Western Europe over the course of this century. Revolutionary socialism, however, has in many respects been the driving force. I think this is really crucial because what happened in 1989 and afterwards is a quite amazing reversal of what most people would have believed the thrust of history was from the late 19th through most of the 20th century. The thrust of history was that Marxism was a dynamic force transforming the world in much the way in which Marx anticipated. Marx says, you know, you can see this if you go, you can see this now for yourself if you go to Humboldt University in Berlin. There's a statue, Marx, you go in the entrance. Marx believed the philosophers have interpreted the world, the point is to change it. Marx wanted to change the world, and Marx did change the world. 20th century history, prior to 1989, when it all goes into reverse, really, in this amazing way, is the history of Marxist revolutions. Starting with the Russian Revolution in 1917, and going through the post-war period, Chinese Revolution, revolutionary transformations in Eastern Europe, the establishment of Soviet-style societies in Eastern Europe, the Cuban Revolution, many revolutions in Africa and in other parts of the world. The 20th century has been the century of socialist revolution. Abruptly, in 1989, with the transformation of Eastern Europe, and following that, the transformation of the Soviet Union itself, it all seems to go into reverse. Is this a true picture? That's one question I'd like to ask. In China, should remember this, China, which makes up a very large proportion of the total world's population, is still a communist state. The Communist Party remains in power in China, but of course what's happened in the Chinese economy is a liberalization of that economy and a reintroduction of the very market mechanisms which Marx was so hostile to. And many people have argued you have two different paths away from communism here. You have the Russian path, which is more radical, which involves, if you like, giving up communism, and the Chinese path, which sustained centralized power of the Communist Party and allowed progressive liberalization of markets. It certainly has been argued that the Chinese model of economic development is more effective than the Russian one, but there are many reasons, I think, to be doubtful about this thesis. Now, in this lecture, or what remains of this lecture, after the first bit was sort of lost, I'd like to raise and try to answer three questions. First, very briefly, given the time, I think, what kind of society was Soviet-style society? What kind of society was it? This form of society which is now disappearing from the world, but which many people thought was the future. Remember the old Webbs, you know, founded the LSE? Incredibly impressed by the Russian Revolution. They certainly thought Soviet-style society was the society of the future. Bertrand Russell thought this at one time. So many Western thinkers believed this, and many continued to believe it right up until the late 1970s, until very recently many Western intellectuals in some sense still held to this view. What kind of society was it that they admired? Second, what were the reasons for its collapse? Because collapse it has been, I think. And third, a bit unlikely to get onto today, but still mention, where do we go from here? What are the likely avenues of transformation in what is now Russia and the ex-Soviet societies of Eastern Europe? First of all, very briefly, then, what kind of society was Soviet-style communism? There was a sort of preeminent classification of this, which many of you might have heard of, but might not be perhaps completely familiar with, which really dates from, say, the 1960s, and it was used right up until 1989, a division between the First World, Second World, and Third World. The anthropologist Peter Worsley seems to take some credit for having invented these distinctions, although other people have also claimed the credit, I have to say, so don't really know. First World, as is used to be used anyway, were the Western liberal democracies of Western Europe, of United States, of Australasia. Third World, the so-called less developed countries of Africa, parts of Asia, South America, and so forth, non-industrialized societies seeking to industrialize. And of course, the Second World was the world of the communist countries essentially having a different model of industrialization from either the First or the Third Worlds. So when you're asking what kind of society was Soviet-style society, leaving aside partly the example of China, which spans these a bit, you're asking what was the Second World like? Of course, what's happened now is that the Second World has disappeared, so these terms don't really have much sense anymore. But you will find in the literature people sometimes speak of Third World countries. That's where that term has its origin. When you're asking what Soviet-style societies were like, first thing to remember is that you're talking of a considerable variety of different countries here. At the time when people used to write about Soviet society, and Soviet-style society, by Soviet-style society, by the way, I mean the Soviet Union and the East European countries prior to 1989. People sometimes use the word totalitarian to refer to these countries, suggesting that they're basically all the same and they all have kind of total political power, but this was never a very good description. In fact, there was a great deal of variety. The Soviet Union itself, you should remember, was an incredibly diverse grouping of different cultures, different languages, different regions. It was never a single unitary totalitarian state. It was something like a commonwealth, if you want to put it charitably, of different cultures, different ethnic groups, different countries, really. These have now, of course, become the independent countries of Central Asia and elsewhere with the breakup of the Soviet Union. within a penumbra of the Soviet Union. I think it's fair to say the Soviet Union was a kind of commonwealth. That is, most of these countries, with the partial exception of the Baltic republics, were not really, I think for the most part, kept within the Soviet Union simply by the use of force. There was quite a strong legitimacy to their involvement with the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union was much more like a commonwealth of nations than it was a unitary totalitarian state, I think. Well, there are many attempts to make it more of a totalitarian state. Together with these, the countries of Eastern Europe, however, were in many respects quite different from the Soviet Union. Eastern Europe, when you add in Eastern Europe, was one sector of Soviet-style society. Here I think you're talking about an empire or a quasi-empire. Countries like Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, as it then was, largely remained in the Soviet bloc because of the use of force, or at least the threat of the use of force, on the part of the Soviet Union. Those countries, as everyone here will know, experienced numerous outbreaks of resistance to Soviet power. It's much more of an imperial system, a quasi-empire, really, when you're talking about the role of the Soviet Union in relation to Eastern Europe. The Eastern European countries differed a lot among themselves. So any broad, brash characterization one makes of Soviet-style society, you have to remember as a simplification. It's actually a very complex group of societies, a commonwealth of societies within a larger quasi-imperial system, sustained ultimately by military power. This is very important because the reason, or one of the reasons, communism was destroyed in the Soviet Union was the rebellion of the East European societies, which eventually created movements which spread back to the Soviet Union. This complex story we'll come on to in a minute. But simplifying, what were some of the characteristics of these types of societies? I'll just list them fairly quickly. Second World societies were different from First World countries in the sense in which they had what's often called a command system economically. By command system essentially means planned production. Marx believed that capitalism is an irrational system. You need to organize, to regulate, to plan economically. This is what Soviet-style society did. The Soviet Union, for example, there were regular five-year plans, which were supposed to be overall plans for the whole economy. They were supposed to generate rapid economic development. And for some part of the Soviet Union's existence, they no doubt did help generate substantial economic development. They weren't just an inhibitor to it. Command economy is an economy where the state dominates economic life. And in greater or lesser degrees, this was true throughout all of the Soviet-style societies. They were not market societies in the sense in which the Western societies have been and remain primarily market societies today. Second, they were of course dominated by the ideology of Marxism. It was Marxist thought which both gave these societies their nominal inspiration and was the main form of political legitimacy in them. However, it was Marxism of a specific kind. This is usually called Marxism-Leninism because of the impact of Lenin's thought. Marxism-Leninism was the official ideology of Soviet-style society. In brief, what Marxist-Leninism declared was that Soviet-style society was a stage beyond capitalism. It would become more productive than capitalism. And in the end, the capitalist societies would have to follow the same model. Marxist-Leninism declares that, or did declare in the post-war period, for example, the Soviet Union was a classless society moving towards what Marx called the higher stage of communism, a stage supposed to combine freedom and wealth quite liberally. This became the official ideology of the system. Thirdly, society marked by collective ownership of the means of production, means of production being industry and agriculture. Very, very different from Western, or from most Western countries anyway. Collective ownership of the means of production was supposed to be the means of producing a classless society. What it meant in practice was that large areas of industry and a great deal of agriculture was collectivized. In the Soviet Union, for example, large chunks of nearly all of the productive system of agriculture was collectivized. Collective farms were established. And Russia, as everyone here again I think will know, is living with the residue of this system today. The collective farms did not prove to be efficient. Soviet agriculture, and then following that, Russian agriculture is vastly less efficient than Western agriculture is. By usual calculations, some 25% of the Russian population are still involved in agricultural production, many of them still in collective settings. They produce less than 1.5% of the American population, which is in the farming agriculture industries. Tremendous contrast. But collectivization was the theme, really, of Soviet-style society. However, I should remember that here there were very big differences. Soviet Union, for example, collective ownership of the means of production went much further than it did in most East European countries. In Poland, for instance, the degree to which agriculture was collectivized was much less than it was in the Soviet Union itself, and you find all sorts of variabilities in the East European countries in the degree to which collectivization was actually implemented. Very important, because it's affected transition processes at the moment in these countries. Fourthly, the dominance of the Communist Party also set these societies apart from Western countries. These Soviet-style society was a one-party state. Not a one-party state in the sense in which there weren't quite a few political parties within these countries. There often were. But the Communist Party was always the dominant political vehicle. The other parties mostly had a nominal existence. The rule of the Communist Party is a key feature of Soviet-style society. What it meant, I think, was that in this kind of society, politics replaced the economy as a major instrument of stratification and as the major instrument of power. In a Western-style society, the economy tends to dominate politics. The economy has an enormous role in influencing other aspects of people's lives, and so, of course, does money on the level of personal life. In the Soviet Union, money was relatively unimportant in everyday life. That is to say, so many things were provided for by the state that money simply did not have the role in people's lives that it has in Western economies. People have far too much money and nothing to buy with it, you could say, again, crudely put, in Soviet-style society. Very, very different, I think, certain periods from our experience here. There are still residues of this. If you go on the Moscow Underground, still extremely, extremely cheap to do so. But of course, access to the wealth generated by production is a different matter. These were quite highly stratified societies, but politics, rather than the economy, was the vehicle of stratification. If you're a top Communist Party official, you had all sorts of privileges. Where you lived, your mobility, you could often shop in dollar shops, unavailable to the rest of the population. But you didn't achieve this through economic power primarily. You achieved it through being an official of the party. In other words, through political power. Political system was a democracy, at least said to be a democracy, because it followed Marx's ideas of democracy. The very idea of a Soviet is a link to the idea of democracy. It's a representative system of Soviets, each of which elect people to higher Soviets or higher collective assemblies. Marx thought that a multi-party system is characteristic of a class society. In a non-class society, you would only effectively need one party, which would represent the general will. What you would do is elect different individuals put up by that party, but you wouldn't have a competitive party system. Marx thought single-party system would be more democratic than a multi-party system. Not many people any longer, I think, could be said to agree with this theorem, because this certainly wasn't the case. It did produce an authoritarian system of rule by a Communist Party officialdom. If you think of one of the things that was so difficult in the Soviet Union, Soviet-style society, for example, succession of the political leadership. You might say, and many people would say, that in Western countries, the average voter doesn't have much power, because all you do is vote every 5 years for two political parties that seem much the same anyway. But what you do have is the chance to get rid of people who you don't like. You do have some influence over political succession. The Soviet Union, political succession, because there were no party mechanisms of this sort, was always a matter of cliques within the Politburo, official squabbles. It was rather like a kind of court in the Middle Ages, powers transferred through all sorts of corrupt means within the higher circles of the Communist Party. Fifthly, it was in many respects a military society, although this was true mainly of the Soviet Union. It's sometimes been called war communism. The experience of the Soviet Union, and indeed of Russia, for anyone here who might come from Russia, or many people have been to Russia, very, very strongly marked by the impact of war. When the early Soviet Union was set up in the 1917, early 20s period, the Western powers immediately sought to invade. The Red Army was created. It resisted these invasions, but it became a central vehicle of Communist Party power. In the Second World War, the Russian population, Soviet population, lost enormous numbers of people in the war. Far, far more than happened in any other West European country, and this shaped the experience of the society. Soviet communism was always shaped by the dominance of war, I think, and by the metaphor of military organization. It's again very important, because when you come on later to the arms race between Soviet Union and the United States, Soviet Union by that period was spending so much on the military that it simply couldn't compete in other areas. Military technology was basically the only advanced form of technology in the Soviet Union by then, and some of it was very, very good. Some Soviet fighter planes are still reckoned to be better than anything the West has constructed, but this was certainly not true of more peaceful areas of economic enterprise. Finally, the whole of Soviet-style society functioned in a bipolar world. That bipolar world was in effect a global system of military alliances, which the United States built on the one hand and the Soviet Union built on the other. You can't understand the nature of Soviet-style society without understanding, in other words, in the Cold War context. It was a quasi-global society in the sense in which the Soviets built a global system of military alliances facing off with the American military alliances. China uneasily sort of suspended between the two. Most of the wars which were fought in the post-war period are often called peripheral wars from the point of view of the main agents. That is, the Soviet Union and the US did not go to war with one another. They fought proxy wars in Vietnam and in other areas of the world, in parts of Africa, where the US propped up all sorts of regimes and the Soviet Union propped up other ones, many of these regimes being noxious ones. This was the history of the involvement of Soviet-style society in this sort of global military ring. Now, this society, it's sort of key thing to mention, I think, seemed to most Western observers to be a stable rival to Western capitalism. It's sort of hard to remember it now, especially for many people here, sort of, I think, coming recently, more recently on the scene, you wouldn't remember anyway, but for most of the period, the post-war period, for example, much of that time, Soviet communism was thought of by everybody as a serious rival to Western capitalism. In the 60s, the Americans worried about whether the Soviet Union would overtake them economically. They based this worry upon statistics of economic development, which seemed to show the Soviet Union was growing more quickly. It also seemed stable. Ernest Gellner, mentioned in the book list, one of the famous professors at the LSE, who comes from Czechoslovakia, and who absolutely hated the Soviets, hated the Soviet system. He's a kind of radical democrat himself. I remember him saying, and you can find him writing, as late as the early 1980s, it'll be 500 years before Soviet communism is changed. It seemed like a stable system, unshakable system of authoritarian power. The fact that it suddenly became overthrown and all this seems so shadowy, I think it's a significant thing has happened to many other institutions. Think of, on a more minor level, think of Lloyd's Insurance Company in this country. Seemed to be the most stable pillar of the British economic system. Suddenly, the late 1980s, all appeared to be undermined and the whole institution seemed on the point of becoming dissolved. Something happened. Something is going on in the wider world which shook all this. But I think you can say confidently, no serious observer of Soviet-style society anticipated the transformations which happened in 1989 and afterwards. No one thought they would occur in the way in which they did. No one anticipated this radical reversal, really, of the historical movement of the 20th century. That's a really interesting issue, why all this happened. Now, I'd like to suggest that to understand why it's happened, of course, it's easy to be wise after the event, but after the event, you can see, I would suggest, three sorts of reasons, really, as to why this occurred. But it is important to stress that no one anticipated it happening in the way in which it did at the time at which it did. So all this is wisdom after the event. First of all, you can say there were a range of contingent or historical factors which were of key importance in what happened in 1989 and after. By contingent factors, I mean things that could have been otherwise in the sequence of events which led from the revolutions of 1989 in Eastern Europe through to the collapse of the Soviet Union. What happened in Eastern Europe was that some East European economies, notably Hungary and Poland, started to liberalize even as early as the late 1970s. In Poland, an oppositional movement known as Solidarity started increasingly openly to challenge the rule of communist power. In other words, there was something of a concerted series of oppositional movements within Eastern Europe that go back some 15 or so years before the revolutions of 1989. And these were gathering force by the latter period of the 1980s, becoming more open, becoming more confrontational. They culminated in open street protest in 1989. Really important in the contingent factors, I think, was the fact that the Soviet Union chose not to intervene militarily. The most significant contingent factor was that Mr. Gorbachev decided not to intervene militarily to prop up, first of all, East Germany, and second, the other states, which then sort of followed it in domino fashion in having a process of quite substantial revolutionary change. In previous periods, in 1968 in Czechoslovakia, for example, the Soviet Union had intervened militarily, And we do know there were plans on the table for the Soviet, for the Red Army, to intervene militarily in 1989 as well. But the Soviet government, under Mr. Gorbachev, decided not to do this. It abandoned the East European countries to their fate. What happened in these countries is essentially there were nationalist revolutions. The changes in 1989 in Eastern Europe were driven by nationalism, driven by a distaste for communism, but fueled very much by a wish to escape from the Soviet imperial system. Nationalism was a prime force in Poland and elsewhere, producing the leverage which allowed these countries to break away. These were not revolutions like traditional revolutions. It's also really interesting, television, electronic communication played a big role in them. Everybody was watching what was happening in the streets of other countries, and they turned out on the streets of their own countries. This even, I think, affected far-off places like South Africa. Transition in South Africa was also part of a kind of global mediated event which followed in a certain sequence from the East European revolutions. Really, really interesting thing of, as it were, late modernity, I think, the televisual age. Second, structural factors. These economies suffered from two basic problems, and these were generic. Sorry, these societies suffered from two basic problems, and these were generic to them. These became accentuated with the passing of time. The first was they were authoritarian systems, unresponsive to the needs of the population, and without mechanisms of communication from the general population to the ruling strata. This produced enormous strains in the evolution of these countries. Second, they were not economically efficient, or they were only economically efficient up to a certain period. The command economy worked pretty well for a certain period, but after that became dramatically inefficient. Economic coupled to political inefficiency was a key structural problem in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union itself. Thirdly, however, to my mind, the key thing that ties it all together, precisely the influence of global factors, the very things I was talking about in the preceding lecture. Broadly put, I think you can say, the Soviet Union, Soviet-style society, remained, roughly speaking, competitive in the world economy during the early period of post-war industrial development. It became out of that economy, unable to compete in that economy, unable to compete in terms of its political mechanisms, once you enter the new age of globalization. Once you enter the age of the information global economy, with a great intensification of global mechanisms, the kind I discussed last time, this is the period at which the Soviet Union and Soviet-style society were not able to keep up with either the economic progress of Western countries or with the political mechanisms of representative democracy developed there. This, I think, I've been trying to argue in the last lecture, is a new type of globalizing order. It's an order which accentuated the existing weaknesses of Soviet-style communism, but it also meant these societies were left behind. Whenever you go to Russia, or you did a few years ago, it's like going to a Western European country some 20 or so years before, dominated by industries which have been largely swept away or radically altered by the information revolution and globalization of economic life in other countries. Now, I think this is what explains the double fall of socialism. That's my final point. You have, of course, the dramatic fall of revolutionary socialism in the Soviet Union, but you also have the end of the period of Keynesian reformist socialism in the West too. Great mistake to suppose that you simply have a situation where the Soviet Union came to an end and the West motored on unchanged. Western societies have also had major problems in entering this new global order. The sorts of reformist socialism, the sorts of welfare state mechanisms which worked so well for the first 30 or so years after the Second World War, become themselves subject to crisis with the era of intensifying globalization. The crisis is therefore not just an Eastern one, it's a Western one too, and we'll trace out some further implications in the next lecture. Thanks very much for coming today anyway.